more of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Last September, the Jewish Museum Milwaukee opened a very special exhibit. Stitching History from the Holocaust is based on the fashion illustrations that Hedy Sternad created in 1938. Hedy and her husband Paul were Czech Jews who were trying to get out of Nazi-occupied Europe. Paul's cousin Alvin lived here in Milwaukee, and it was to him that the illustrations were sent in support of their U.S. visa application.
Unfortunately, like so many others, the Sternads didn't make it out. But the illustrations had become part of the permanent collection at the Jewish Museum. And last year, thanks to the costume shop at the Milwaukee Rep, the clothes Hedy Sternad had only sketched out became physical reality. And now, thanks to UW-Milwaukee's Digital Humanities Lab, they and the story they tell about two people lost in the Holocaust will remain permanently available to the public.
Ellie Gettinger is the education director for the Jewish Museum Milwaukee, and Rachel Baum is adjunct assistant professor of Jewish studies at UWM. I met them recently at the Jewish Museum. Thank you both for joining me this morning. Ellie, start out by telling us where we are and what we're looking at.
You're in the changing gallery of the Jewish Museum Milwaukee, and right now we have our exhibit, Stitching History from the Holocaust, which is based on pieces that are in our permanent collection. There were 8 dress designs that were sent to Milwaukee in 1939 in the hopes of getting visas to get out of Nazi Europe, and they were sent to a Milwaukee cousin. Now, these languished in a basement for years. When they were found, they were donated to the Milwaukee Jewish Archives, which became the museum. And in 2008, when we opened, they were part of our permanent collection. We've had these dresses created, and we're using them as a way of exploring the loss of the Holocaust and giving a sense of the people, not just, you know, these kind of broad movements, but here's what happens to two people when they're swept up in a totalitarian regime and when no one is kind of concerned, even though the Milwaukee family was actually quite concerned and just couldn't do anything because there was more bureaucracy and red tape.
And that was a common thing mm-hmm. that happened. I mean, there were lots of people who were concerned but couldn't actually navigate all of the stuff they needed to do to save people.
Right. There were only 3,000 visas a year that were available from Czechoslovakia. And so in order for Paul and Hedy, our designer, to get here, they had to get in under that visa quota. They had to be able to demonstrate all of their financial needs. They had to demonstrate that they were citizens in good standing in Czechoslovakia, which meant getting a document from the Gestapo that said they're citizens in good standing. And then on the American side, you had to show that this person that you were bringing in wasn't going to fall on the welfare of the state, which is why they were trying to get affidavits of necessity based on the strength of the designs, to say that this is someone who could come here and design clothing, and she would be part of the manufacturing scene of Milwaukee, which was considerable in the 1930s and 40s. It was a large scene, and so it's not out of the realm of, you know, question for them to say, oh, yeah, we could totally get in and do something here.
So, Rachel, I know you have an interesting piece that you're kind of taking this exhibit, which is closing in a couple of months, but you're extending it to sort of permanent life.
Yeah, which has been really exciting, working with the Digital Humanities Lab at UWM. I was originally connected with this project because the museum had asked me and several other scholars, including Rachel Buff from UWM, to contribute to the catalog. And I was immediately hooked and just saw the importance of this story. And at the same time, the Digital Humanities Lab at UWM had just opened, and they were looking for projects. And I just saw right away, we need to tell this story. We need to tell it digitally so that, as you say, it can live forever.
So as a professor, and you're dealing with Jewish studies all the time, what makes this story so compelling, and how do you use it in your classrooms?
I think this story is so compelling because it starts out with so few artifacts. When we teach the Holocaust, students either get really overwhelmed by the numbers, right? We have, you know, 6 million Jews, millions of non-Jews, and it's really hard for them to personalize who were these individuals. Or sometimes then they read a story of a survivor, and they hear about it from somebody who survived, so they're getting, in some ways, a skewed perspective, because everyone you hear from is somebody who survived. But here we have these artifacts. They're like treasures that are left from somebody who's no longer here. And then it's our job to figure out what can we know based on this single letter, which became 2 letters, mm-hmm. and Even three. Three letters and these dresses. And it's just so compelling. Students get really pulled into the story and the work of figuring out how we can help these artifacts to tell their story.
So what do we know? What have we learned from these artifacts and from this wonderful exhibit?
So we started with this first letter dated December 1939. It says we're looking for affidavits of necessity. It never says the name of the designer. And so that was really our research starting point, figuring out who she was and, you know, being able to tell that story as much as possible. We were able to, through the Yad Vashem names database, find the name of the designer, Hedvig. And then we were also able to track down a niece that had survived because she was on kinder transport. And through that process, it kind of snowballed as we, you know, I think the day that we found, and we'd been looking for the niece for like 4 years, when our intern who happened to be in Germany sent me back a phone number and I sent this on to Rachel, I think we both like squealed. Like, I think we were like, oh my gosh, are you serious? And so he interviewed her and we were able to develop this kind of personal sense of who she was and who Paul was. And that gave us a lot more to go by. She then sent us another letter that had been written by Paul to her father, Ernst. This one's in German. And at the bottom of that, we had Hedy's signature. From there, the family in Milwaukee was kind of looking around, and they found this third letter. This third letter really was the most – I can't imagine anywhere in my career I'm going to find a primary resource with more information in it. It's dated October 1938, so right after Germany takes over the Sudetenland, and it says, you may have read in the press what a catastrophe has overtaken our country. So whereas that first letter that we had is really quiet in its desperation, that first actual letter in chronology is incredibly loud and prescient. It says the only thing left to do is to consider immigrating from Europe. And he sees this the minute the Germans come into the country. And it totally changed the tenor of this story, but it also sets up a really beautiful timeline of the Czech Jewish experience around the Nazi occupation and subsequent Holocaust.
So how does finding these primary sources and doing this exhibit, how does that contribute to overall scholarship? Are there other examples that are like this, that this is comparable to, or is this pretty unique?
I think both are true. I think that there has been more attention lately on material objects. I know there was just something in the paper about, you know, objects being donated to museums and how can we learn about the lives of people from these objects that they left behind. But because of the local connection here, I think this is also a unique exhibit. It's really tremendous and amazing that we have this letter from this family and then where it went. And you can hear as Ellie's talking of the excitement of discovery. And, you know, I kept thinking that it's like a whodunit, except we know how the story ends. And so we get pulled into the story not because we want to know if they're going to live or die, because unfortunately we know that they died, but we get pulled into the story because we care about them. And we start to understand that finding out facts about Paul and Hedy Stranad matters, and that we're sort of bringing them back to life in some way. I mean, not in reality, of course, unfortunately, but in our memory, and it's significant.
I mean, I think you bring this up in your essay. Generally, when you have someone like this, they didn't have children. There's no one really left to remember these people, and that is an incredibly important concept in Judaism, the idea of remembering the dead and honoring those who came before you. You know, every year on the memorial of someone's death, you're supposed to say a blessing, and these are people who were lost to that. You know, there was no one really left to mourn them. I'm sure their niece mourned them, but, you know, that's a secondary relationship. So we have built this statement of who these people were, how they lived, because that's really more of the focus, and where their talents were, and celebrated that as opposed to, yes, and they were two people who were murdered in the Holocaust. Like, that is the focus of this exhibit. And I hope it becomes a jumping off point of not just Milwaukee thinking, but broader thinking as well, that, you know, here are two people. Can I find more people? Can we discover those stories of how people lived and what their lives were like, so that we're reclaiming them?
Well, and you can see that in the wonderful exhibit that's outside from Arts at Large, that idea that we can engage with the work that they weren't able to complete. So Hedy wasn't able to complete these dresses, but the museum has brought them to life. And now a new generation has taken that up and is doing something else with them. And if that message travels around the country as the exhibit travels, I think that's very powerful.
So talk a little bit about the digital archive part of this. What is it going to look like, and what are you planning to do with it?
Well, it is up now, so you can go see it at www.uwm.edu/stitchinghistory. But it's going to grow. So we wanted to get something up while the exhibit was still live, but we have also bigger dreams for the exhibit, especially as it travels. It's interesting because the digital exhibit is an exhibit. It's intended not just to be a website, but to be an exhibit that tells a story about artifacts. And the story it tells is slightly different than the story that the museum exhibit tells. So we're hoping that people will do both, and will start thinking about the question of, what are the different stories you can tell about artifacts that are left behind? So the digital exhibit focuses very much on the making transparent the work of stitching a life story. And we use that metaphor of stitching the dresses and stitching a life story and how the pieces get pulled together in various ways and how that work continues on. But we're excited to see where it's going to go as well as we are able to add more artifacts and hopefully as new things come out.
So when you're talking about adding more artifacts, obviously not about the Strenads, but about other people, or are you trying to keep it within this one particular story?
You know, honestly, even in terms of the information about the Strenads that we have, we don't have everything yet up on the site, in part because this was time-dependent, and we wanted to tell the story. But then also thinking about how other people will engage with it, whether it will grow in certain ways, and you know, there's so many stories that can be told about a single dress, right? And part of our work now is to think about how can we keep the site engaging and interesting and grow it so that it's not just a website that's going to be static, but it is really going to be a place where the public can engage with these questions of memory and artifacts in the humanities.
And I think it's a super attractive part of the exhibit itself that, yes, when we are traveling this exhibit, that people can see the dresses, they can come in, but there's also a place that they can grow this collection of thought and this body of thinking that this isn't something that says, okay, this is the way this exhibit looks and it needs to be duplicated exactly as such at our future venues. But if, say, this goes to Houston, and in Houston there's a story of, you know, someone else who is trying to get over, or something else with that kind of connection, so that we can build this body of work on, you know, who was trying to get here, who made it, who didn't, what were the differences in those stories, how are these things related, and that the digital exhibit can be a unifier between those things, I think it would be an amazing accomplishment of this exhibit.
Is this a new way of thinking about history? Is this a new way of getting people to engage with it?
I think it's really the excitement of digital humanities. I mean, I've been thinking about that term and thinking about, you know, we often think of it as using digital tools to do the traditional work of humanities. But of course, it works in the other way too, that the digital is changing how we do the humanities, but also that the humanities are changing how we're thinking about the digital. So I've been thinking about that question of how do you get students to connect with the 6 million or the millions of non-Jews as well. It's so big, and I've been thinking about that as a question of what now we, in the digital world, we call big data, right? That the Holocaust has a big data problem in a way. There's so much information, and the question is, how do you humanize that data? How do you bring it down for students so that they really understand not millions of people, but one person and one person and one person? And I think that that is something that the digital realm can actually help us to do.
I think you established my thinking on this, Rachel, by saying she called this a work of microhistory, and not in a demeaning, oh, look at your history, it's so little. No, but that there's this transition in thinking that instead of, okay, we're going to look at the history of broad sweeping movements and this is the great man approach to, this is the history of a lived experience. This is the history of one or two people and their lives, and that's what this is. And I think that the digital humanities is a great way of connecting with that, because not everybody is going to be able to walk into Jewish Museum Milwaukee, but this makes it fully democratic because it's on the internet, and if you find this piece, then suddenly you're connected to it.
And it's, again, bringing it down to the personal level. I mean, we need, as human beings, we need to make that personal connection mm-hmm. for it to work on mm-hmm. us. Because if it's too abstract, we're just going to go, okay, that was terrible. And right. you move on.
I was thinking about connecting this to the importance of story, mm. right? That there's so much interest today on hearing stories of other people. And the reason why stories are so important is because of what you're saying, that it allows us to personalize, to understand one person's lived experience. And Hetty couldn't tell her own story, but this is our efforts to tell her story for her, or to allow her story to be told in multiple ways by multiple people. I think that's the power of it.
I want to thank you both so much for taking time to talk with me this morning, and best of luck with the archive and with the future of the exhibit. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Ellie Gettinger is the Education Director for the Jewish Museum Milwaukee. Rachel Baum is Adjunct Assistant Professor of Jewish Studies at UWM, and she's also part of the university's Digital Humanities Project.
The Stitching History from the Holocaust exhibit remains on view at the Jewish Museum Milwaukee until March 1st and is online now at UWM's Digital Humanities Lab. There are links at wuwm.com. That's all for the Wednesday edition of the program. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for spending some time with us today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect.
It's on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, your NPR station in Milwaukee. Keep listening. All the latest news is coming your way in about an hour on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR in Boston. But right now, it's 11 o'clock, and Fresh Air is next.